spoke about several approaches towards the age of the universe. One of them was the science is bad. But we do not like science approach. Right? That's approach number one. Approach number two is the Mabul. What? As I told you last week, the Sforno said that the earth was tilted on its axis. The axis of the earth was tilted during the flood, and obviously that's what goes in for closer seasons, says the Sforno. The Mercede, who's a 19th century source who was after Darwin, posits that the age of the universe was made older by the flood, and that the all the great dinosaurs and stuff which they found were destroyed in the flood. They all were destroyed. They all existed before the flood and were destroyed in the flood. And the seed is a commentary on Chumash called the Ha Makes Dogma. They have a Jewish Yeshiva, I'm sure. It's in its own paper. But he says that he supposes that the universe, much of what went on in the universe, which we no longer have, except that extinct animals happened in the flood. The third interpretation we said we had was the world is created mature, which means looks old. And in this handout, this is the definitive article on the age of the universe. This article you have here on page 3. I like the way he puts it. It was in the original copy. He was nastier and sharper.
Aria Kaplan.
So you see on the bottom left, bottom right, he says, the simplest approach is to ignore the problem. I know an Orthodox biology professor who is in synagogue staunchly maintains that the world is less than 6,000 years old, but in class teaches the standard scientific chronology. It is as if he had one belief system when among Orthodox people and another when among his professional colleagues. This may be the easiest way out, but it is obviously not a satisfactory approach. This, by the way, would be the approach taken by Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was a very smart fellow, who was Rashid at YU for many years, his approach towards questions of Torah and Mada was that one should learn to live with paradox, right? That the systems are separate, they're not meant to be reconciled, they can both be true simultaneously in their own way, and there's not any questions to be raised from one on the other.
I like that.
I don't.
Okay, that means if you think about it for a moment, if you're familiar actually with his way of learning, the Brisker style of learning, which his grandfather, Chaim Brisker, was instituted. The Brisker style of learning is to categorize everything into two separate categories. In other words, to categorize things carefully and separate them by their traits, and then you understand everything, as long as everything is categorized very well. So basically, he's doing the same thing. So in the two separate categories, one thing is true in one of the dimensions, another thing is true in another dimension. Why bother worrying about it? Just learn to eat. Why does this game make you so happy?
I'm just happy that science is a responsible authority who takes that approach. That's the way.
Why do you like that approach?
Does the approach appeal to you, or the fact that there's an authority you hold that way?
I haven't found anything that's appealing to me, so absent a real appealing unifying theory, that seems the rational way to go. You have an appealing unifying theory?
I don't know. You'll have to see if it's appealing to you. How am I supposed to know if it's appealing to you?
Okay. Well, what's the end of the class?
Isn't that just based on ignorance, though?
What?
Like, it's sort of going like number one.
It's not science, it's bad. It's not simple
ignorance.
It's willful ignorance.
Right.
Right. So
it's based upon ignorance.
But it's intentional ignorance. In other words, you're saying the first opinion says science is bad, right? And we ignore science. The second opinion, this opinion says, no, science is good. Torah is good. Everything's good. Right?
Oh.
Now, why bother trying to make problems for yourself? Everything is good. Why? I don't know. But I'll learn Torah well, and I'll learn science well, and everything will be fine.
So what does he say when his kid asks how old the universe is?
Torah methodology leads to this answer. Scientific methodology leads to that answer. You do the best you can over under each methodology, and you simply say, here's the answer the Torah comes to, here's the answer that science comes to. We'll keep working on both, but let me have lunch.
I disagree.
Okay. this is the approach, as I said, which a Rabbi Soloveitchik, a relative, I would like to digress. Once Rabbi Soloveitchik gives an amazing speech, which actually was what turned me off from Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy, which I heard once. You should know Rabbi Soloveitchik produced many, many tapes over the course of the years. And I actually heard him in person in English. I once went to Boston while he was still alive to listen to his class his first summer. And he was a brilliant, brilliant person and a tremendous magicier. But when I listened to his Yiddish tapes, my Yiddish is not great. You know, a little, enough to almost great by. Not quite, but almost great by. So, but his Yiddish tapes are so powerful, so eloquent. You could tell that was, in English he was talking because he knew English better than all the students, but it was his second language. In Yiddish he was so incredibly eloquent, so incredibly moving and dramatic. So he gave one speech in Yiddish in the 1950s, with which he was the speech, a speech about Torah and secular studies, or Torah and science. And he said, he gave a whole beautiful metaphor. He said, Torah and science, in our perspective, meaning his perspective, are two mountains which face one another. We do not try to combine them, merge them, or overcome the differences between them. We build a bridge from one to another, and we live on both of them simultaneously. That was his perspective, which means that unlike in, say, the Hirschian perspective, where Derech Eretz, which is his name for secular knowledge or study or pursuit, is a part of Torah, and is, a tool for Torah, a tool to either to learn Torah or to live Torah, according to the Soloveitchik, Rabbi Soloveitchik's philosophy, it's not a tool. It's a separate area of life in and of itself, which has validity independently and in and of itself, not as a part and parcel of Torah. That's why, although nobody understands why, most people understand why, that's why the Hirschians, who are into secular studies and secular knowledge and secular pursuits, were very, very adamantly opposed to Torah Umaga, the Yeshiva University philosophy, which also seems to espouse secular knowledge, secular studies, and secular pursuits. Why? What's the difference between the two? This difference. From the Hirschian perspective, everything is encompassed in Torah. Whatever it is, whatever it deals with. From the Torah Mada perspective of YU, so no, there's Torah and there's secular knowledge. And they're both great, but they're both separate. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says in the statement, very eloquent way, far more eloquent than one could say it in English, that building a bridge between the two of them entails living in two worlds which cannot be reconciled one with the other.
But if we say that Torah is a blueprint of everything in the universe, including everything, then of course that other mountain has to be part of the other mountain. I don't see how you can have two separate realities. What is he saying? That Hashem created one world where we're living in a Beit Medrash, and then he created another world where there are stars and galaxies. But for some reason those two worlds are separate, and that the Torah has nothing to do with the second one.
I would say that Rabbi Soloveitchik would ask you, I'm guessing, when he says Torah, he means Rambam. He means, you know, Gemara, Halachic Gemaras also, preferably, not these Agadic Gemaras.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying that maybe somebody on some level, somewhere, can learn somehow the relationship between Halacha and the creation of the universe in some direct way. But for us, who cannot, and should not. So for us, it must remain separate and coexist.
Oh, so when he says Torah, he doesn't mean the Torah, he means learning Torah,
The study of Torah,
like Gemara,
the pursuit of Torah and its knowledge. Should not attempt to use science to understand Torah, nor Torah to understand science.
Ah,
all
right.
Seems to me that instead of two mountains, it's sort of like a Venn diagram with two circles that overlap each other.
Not according to no. That is the world according to Siegel, but not the world according to Torah. Not the same thing.
If you're looking, say, at the question of the age of the universe, you'll have the Torah view and the scientific view, and if you list all the elements of both, you might find that there are some things that overlap and that they are consistent. And you just have to say that they're consistent in these, they're inconsistent in these. From what we know now, there are inconsistencies that are in two different realms. We might learn more in the future, but I'm not going to worry about it.
That's an interesting approach. Again, it's not Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach. Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach is that from 9 to 3, which was scheduled YU, from 9 to 3, you are in a Beit Medrash. You are learning Torah, you are completely immersed in Torah. From 3 to 9, whatever time it is, you are in a college library. You are completely immersed in whatever discipline you are pursuing, you have nothing to do with Torah. You have two separate hats.
Didn't he say that your ethics are informed by Torah? To the extent that secular studies require you to have some worldview, some point of view, wouldn't he borrow the Torah point of view?
I don't think he borrows. I think he takes the Torah view lock, stock, and barrel.
Right.
And I think he would say that, you know, whatever philosophy or science or literature studying should not inform your ethics.
No. But I'm saying when you're studying science, when you're studying secular philosophy, when you're studying human systems, and there comes a question of ethics, you would apply Torah ethics to that question.
True, but that's not really science. That's, you know, the ethics of science.
Right.
So wait, so he would say you went to YU, so in the morning you would be learning a shir about Bereshis, and they'd be saying the world is 5,765 years old from the creation. And then in the afternoon, your professor tells you the world is 13 billion years old.
That's exactly what happens today.
Right. And then you're supposed to just say, okay, and not say, well, wait, what? So you have to in your mind, say that one of them is wrong. Either there's some missing information, or one of either my morning class or my afternoon class is wrong, because you can't have two numbers.
Right, so his demand to you would be, no, either both is right. If you're looking for reconciliation, when Moshiach comes, we can worry about that.
Yeah.
Right now, you should...
Right. We read 1984.
Yeah.
It's double think.
Yeah.
I never read 1984.
Isn't there a quote, some great philosopher person said, that the mark of an intelligent or enlightened person is the ability to maintain two contradictory concepts in his head at the same time?
Yeah, but that's not the same thing as intentionally, you know, it's not, you should be able to if necessary, but doesn't mean that that's the end of the process.
Right.
In other words, in a Hersheyan school, then none of them exist. There are no Hersheyan schools. They don't exist today. So in a Hersheyan school, what would happen is that the instructor, he writes this explicitly, he says the instructor of biology or chemistry or whatever it is should be an Orthodox Jew, who teaches how chemistry, how biology, how whatever it is meaningful to a person who wants to be more religiously observant, religiously knowledgeable, religiously functioning, because everything fits in to that grand whole, which is the world of Torah and the Derech Eretz to which it is linked. But in a YU perspective, no! For your chemistry, you get the biggest apicurus in the world if you have to, as long as he's an expert in his subject.
Why would you want apicurus teaching your kids?
Because he's the best scientist.
So you get an Orthodox guy.
But that's not, I'm telling you, that's not, you know, that's not the way it is. I'm telling you, that's the difference of perspective. It's a very big difference of perspective, right?
Right.
It's a question of who most rigorously applies the methodology of science and of a particular discipline. Hey, you can have a religious guy, I suppose, who is rigorous in his application of science. Says, look, you do this experiment, we do these investigations, and we come up with this answer, and it's inconsistent with what we know about what we believe about the Torah. But here's what we believe about the Torah. Here's the result of the scientific test. It's inconsistent. And maybe one day it'll be resolved by further testing, and maybe it'll never be resolved in this world. We'll have to wait for the next world. But as a person of faith, you're committed to observe the Torah view in terms of your religious worldview.
Seems a little too Christian.
Yeah, I don't like that. I don't like approach. I agree. I think it seems too Christian. I think it means that you basically tell the guy to sacrifice his mind at the front door, which I don't like. Or check his mind at the front door. Sorry, mixed metaphor. So check his mind at the front door, which I don't like.
At the very least, you should learn from it.
But in YU, or a situated local, or a institution of that ilk, not only do they not say that, but on the contrary, the professor is free to say to students, as many of them do, that what you're learning in the morning, that's baloney. This is where it's at. So the Rosh Hashiva tells them, what you're learning in the afternoon, that's baloney. This is where it's at. The professor tells them, what you're learning in the morning, that's baloney. This is where it's at. And the student, of course, comes out with a nice, holistic, wholesome view of what Judaism is all about. That is a surprise. Actually, you should know also, as a result, once on the topic, that system, the YU system, only works well. It does work well for some people who are very, very brilliant and very, very Lithuanian. Because in order to excel in both systems, you have to be very, very smart, because they're both very, very intense and rigorous simultaneously, right? And also, you have to be able to compartmentalize and not really have any emotional attachment to any one side or the other, because then that side is going to win out. So you have to be able to live so well with paradox that everything is just a cold analytical issue by you and not something which actually has any meaningful significance in your life. Okay, so that is...
And that's not laden with value judgments at all.
Oh, no. That was clearly objective. No. Clearly objective.
That was very little lane.
So, going on here, he says, another approach is taken by the many, I didn't put down this approach, the approach, two-world approach. I guess I should put it down.
Two-systems approach. Which really isn't an approach, it's a don't think about this.
Right.
So Solon Basic is the two-systems approach.
It's an approach to not approach it.
Right.
Okay.
Don't get too close. So, another approach is taken by many Orthodox Jews who maintain that science in general is a fraud.
And airplanes are magic.
Largely because of this very issue. For those who hold this view, the moral shortcomings of scientists are taken as evidence of their intellectual dishonesty. However, this too is a totally unsatisfactory approach, as would be evident to anyone even remotely connected with organized science. Fortunately, in many yeshivas today, we've managed to keep people away from organized science altogether.
Why fortunately?
Right?
Why fortunately?
Maybe facetiously, but that way you can actually assume that science has no validity if you're not, you don't have any...
No one asks how the radio works?
No, nobody cares. Now, all due fairness, I think your average...
Lakewood guy?
Joe Goy really couldn't care less how his radio works. He has no clue how his high-definition TV works.
But
he knows he likes to watch.
But he knows that there is an explanation of how it works because people use it to build it.
That's true. The fellow in Yeshiva also knows there's some reason why his cell phone works or whatever it is. But that's not concern, right? It concerns some, these people in Japan who's all making his cell phone. That was not his concern. So they're not... The scientific method is fallen. Turn the page.
That method is based purely on ignorance.
What?
This method here is basically based on complete lack of study of what science is.
Right.
Lack of complete ignorance.
Two popular solutions take the problem out squarely. By the way, I want to tell you guys something. I was asked by, I think Rabbi Tendler was the one who organized it. They're having a seminar sometime, an ongoing seminar for a few professionals here in North America over the course of the year, at some point, I don't know. So they wanted me to speak on what issues do people find important in terms of Jewish thought? So if you guys want to make a list for me, I'll tell you what issues
all they care about are shekels and machitzes.
Yeah. So in other words, so Jewish philosophy, Jewish thought, what issues are important for a Jew professional to address? So if you want to let me know, I'll be able to tell them. So two possible solutions take the problem on squarely. The first assumes that each day of creation was really millions or even billions of years long. This approach, the long day approach, we actually haven't discussed yet. The long day approach is associated in our day and age with Rabbi Schwab.
I didn't know anyone held this anymore.
Rabbi Schwab says that we say in Shabbos morning in Pesukei Dezima, we say, Ki elef shanim beinecha kiyom etmol ki yagor. For 1,000 days are in your eyes like yesterday which has passed. So we see there a source, and it's brought down in Tractate Sub Medrash, which indicates that the day of Hashem is 1,000 years old. We'll actually come back to this later on.
2,000
years. 2,000 years. What? I made a mistake there. Ki elef shanim, 1,000 years. They map on your eyes, feel it's more like one day. So Rabbi Schwab says, 1,000 years, a billion years. What's the difference? Right? Mm-hmm. Once a day is longer than a day is longer than 24-hour day, so it doesn't matter how long it is. So even though the Torah says 6 days of creation, it means 6 epochs of creation.
So what he is saying then is that the biblical story of creation is a metaphor, it reduces the reality of it to a story we can understand.
That's correct. And the proof of that would be, the evidence of that would be that there is no sun or moon in the story until the fourth day. how did you measure days before there was a sun or moon?
There was no one to measure a day.
Right, and there was no one to measure a day for that matter until Friday. So therefore, the idea of day, as that argues Rabbi Schwab, is a relative idea, not an absolute idea, certainly till Wednesday, till the sun and moon was created, and it could be many, many eons of years. And this has some appeal to it, because, again, this idea of the moon and sun only coming in much later to the picture, not being any human being until much later in the picture, this makes it appealing to you know, take on the position that, well, the days are much longer. Okay?
Does anyone know, like, just the fact that we know about general relativity and that time is not a fundamental constant, like people thought for the last thousands of years, that time is actually goes at different rates for different points of view. Can't someone just say that and that's it? You say 6 days. Yeah, so 6 days.
Yeah, that's Schroeder.
Yeah,
kind of like Schroeder. Schroeder takes it to an tries to make it into a specific extreme, but the concept is valid. Time really is not still. I mean, we've proven this with clocks. Like time is at different rates for different people, depending on how fast they're going. So like, once you say that time and space are, and they say like at the creation, time and space were one thing and the same, couldn't distinguish them. So once you say that, time can have any meaning, 6 days can have any meaning you want. So
but I don't know why Rabbi Kaplan, who certainly was knowledgeable in physics, did not actually come up with the Schroeder idea before Schroeder. It could be that he was so fixated on the answer he had that he didn't pay attention to the possibility of the Schroeder answer. But what's known as the Schroeder answer is really a separate answer. The Schroeder answer is the answer which says
time and space are one.
I wouldn't put it that way for layman. That the 6 days are relative time.
That's what Rabbi Schwab is saying, too.
Right, Rabbi Schwab is saying that it's absolute to time. In other words, the lesson of time is slowing down and speeding up. Each day was a billion years. Or a million years, whatever.
You mean he divides it equally?
Yeah.
He says take 15 billion divided by 6.
Right.
That's what he says each day.
Whatever is necessary, right.
Okay.
So,
and Schroeder,
unrelative time. If I recall correctly, he has written 2 books on this subject, and it's complex. But the way he says it, imagine if you have somebody going at the speed of light, traveling speed of light, and at the same time somebody who's observing him from a stationary viewpoint. So his perspective, and again, since I have no way of proving this, or this point because I'm not a physicist, but he's content that since, as we know from Einstein's theory of relativity, when you approach the speed of sound, of light, then time slows down dramatically. So therefore, the person who's traveling the speed of light, for him, 6 days will pass, and the same time that for an observer on the ground, 15 billion years would pass.
So it's 6 days at the speed of light.
Except the problem with his approach, I think, is that the observer, he puts as the center of the universe, which is really everywhere. But the idea is correct. The idea is that if you, depending on how your relative speed to something else, time shifts. But the reason is because time and space are actually one sort of thing, and that it's just that time is actually just a fourth dimension, so to speak. So like it can bend, can't go backwards, but it can bend. So yeah. So basically, like what can be described as 6 days can actually be any time you want. Like a second can be any time you want, depending on how fast you're going relative to
that. That is relative to your speed. So therefore, at the time that universe is
fast.
Yeah,
you can't go faster than
speed. You can't go faster than the speed of light, but you can keep adding minus to the decimal point to get to the time I want.
Schroeder would say the only entity which can go beyond the speed of light is God. And that would explain all sorts of things. Like, because he's beyond time.
So and that light particle experiences no time.
Yeah, but Hashem doesn't need to travel.
What? That's the point. It's beyond time.
Right.
Beyond time is beyond space. Beyond
light
energy.
Itself doesn't really feel like it's traveling.
What?
If you were a light particle and you were flying a billion years across a galaxy, you would not even think a second one, because there is no time when you're in a light particle. Because time slows down, but when you go to the speed of light, the light itself experiences absolutely no time.
Right.
It does not experience. It doesn't know what time is. There is no time for a little time.
No, a little fire.
What? It doesn't know it's traveling. It sees the entire universe from beginning to the end in a split second, if you can call it that.
See, the entire history of the universe. According to us. According to it, it existed and always existed and always will exist in all the entire creation, entire time.
Principle.
Okay, so that
was Schroeder. I forget. It's a long time since I read Genesis, the Big Bang. But he was talking about oscillating time. Was that right? There was a wrinkle in the space time continuum.
It's linear.
Okay.
I mean, I know what you mean by wrinkle, but it's not, you know, like the sky drops into a wormhole and then the time changed, but rather things were going very fast and then they slow down. I'm not sure I understand the question, but I think it's not oscillating, but rather...
Well, he was going through the different lengths of each day.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you go oscillating, I would assume it means up to like alternating currents where it goes back and forth.
Use the analogy, I think, of wavelength.
The
distance between the crests was longer and longer.
So there's two different approaches, Rabbi Schwab and Schroeder. And again, as I say, the Rabbi Kaplan does not bring down ever the Schroeder type approach. You see here from what he says. He says that there are a number of difficulties of this approach, not the least, but actually it is the only major difficulty, that there is no hint of it anywhere in the classical Torah literature. Meaning, yeah, sure. Why not say days a billion years old? Clouds a billion years. Brahma is the Ramban saying Chovish Nachmanides. He says explicitly, a day was a day. It was a 24-hour day. Don't think it was a longer day. People say that they're wrong.
Then do you know?
Right, that's true.
He's Ramban.
But the thing is that we're assuming that he's reflecting the Torah thought up to his time. So therefore, for Rabbi Schwab to say this, he really has to go back and leapfrog over years of Jewish tradition, go back to the Bible without any filter of Jewish tradition, read it independently, and come to that conclusion. Can he do that? Yes.
So this is our Rabbi Schwab's father?
Yes.
Great.
Yes. So you can go to start the issue with him.
I'm going to have to shake his hand. His dad was a radical thinker.
So it's not the only radical thing his father said. Actually, want me to tell the most radical thing his father said? The most radical thing his father ever said, which is a very, very dangerous thing. And his father was, the way, that's what they say, I don't know if it's true, they say his father was compelled to retract his position even though he didn't want to retract it. Okay? You can ask Rabbi Schwab if he really retracted it or not. There's a discrepancy in the Jewish history books between the time of destruction of the, between Jewish and non-Jewish history books, between as to when the first temple was destroyed. In the non-Jewish histories, in all secular histories, and even some Jewish histories, the date of the destruction of the first temple was 586 BCE. According to Talmudic sources, the date of the destruction of the first temple was 166 years later. 166 means 420 BCE. Going from years go backward before the common year. 165 missing years. 166 missing years. Where did they go? Right? So there are many answers to that question. Where did they go? This is a big issue in Jewish history. Anybody ever hear this issue before?
Wait, so the Jewish sources say that it was built, it was lasting longer than normal.
What?
The calculation that lasted 410 years, that includes 166 years?
Calculation what?
If they say that the temple stood, the first one for 410, the first one for 420 years.
No, that only works for this calculation.
Right.
But the second temple lasted much longer. But the second temple was rebuilt 70, everybody reads it 70 years later, the second temple. So that was 516 CE. And this one, this, or 350 CE, according to this one. And instruction was in... It's really not 70, it's 68, but let's use the 70 number for argument purpose. You know what has to be 68 and not 70? Does anybody understand that? I tried to explain this once and I remember.
Yeah, because it goes from -1 to 1.
Okay, so we'll use the 70 in order to avoid that issue, right? So this is 420 years, and if you use the 516 and go to 70, then you get 586 years.
For the second temple. So the first temple would have stood less time.
First temple stood 410 years, according to both.
According to both?
Yeah.
How can it be according to both if they have two different destruction dates?
What? Because it starts earlier.
Two different start dates, two different construction dates.
So question, where happened to 165 years? For Rabbi Schwab. It's an amazing one. But I can't I feel very uncomfortable every time I say it over. He says, Chazal covered up the 165 years.
What do you mean covered up?
They covered up. No.
Wait, they're saying it's younger or older?
It's really that old. The second Rabbi Strauss is really the second starting to write. And the world is 165 years older than we think it is. I mean, the 5765 plus 165. Actually, this year is year number 5920. Oh.
And they covered it up why?
Wait, that means in 80 years the Shev is coming?
They covered it.
Rabbi
Schwab says the cover-up was so successful that we don't know why they covered it. I'm not kidding.
That sounds like those newspapers with the liberal symbols all over them, the conspiracy newspapers and stuff. The government covered it up. Why? Too much of a cover-up.
Like, oh, I said, Roswell, where's the point
right.
Focus?
Right. Yeah. I don't think I can hang on for another 80.
What do you mean by cover up? You mean stuff, bad stuff happened in those
bad
years?
Stuff happened. We don't know what it is, but bad stuff happened.
Really?
Where is the source for this? Why did he think this?
Made it up. He has...
What's going on?
We already know bad stuff went on in the second temple.
To figure it out?
What?
The logic he used to figure it out.
That's what he said. It must be missing. It must be the cover up. That was his... He has an allusion to it. I don't think... It's only allusion to it if you assume that it's an allusion to it. But there's something in Daniel, in the book of Daniel. It says, and now take the book and close it till the end of time. So it says, what book is he telling to close? Ooh, the 165-year book. That's what he told him to close. To snap it shut. And he snapped it shut. And that was that. So his source for saying that, I shouldn't say source, his precedent for saying this, is in the Bible itself, in the Torah, there is a 38-year gap. The 38-year gap is between the sin of the spies, shortly thereafter, and the death of Miriam. Right? Shortly after the death of spies, they got the mitzvah of Paraduma, the mitzvah of the red heifer, right? So somebody comes Tame. And from the mitzvah of Paraduma to the next pasuk, there's a gap of 38 years.
What do you mean, a gap?
The Torah skipped 38 years.
Well, he skipped a bunch of years of Moses' life, too.
True. But he says, that 38-year gap is the precedent for his gap of 165 years. Again, the same idea. 38 years, 165 years, what difference does it make? There's a,
It's not accounted for,
right. So the problem with that is that those 38 years are not exactly accounted for, because the Torah says, at the end of Bamidbar, it says, and they travel from here to there, travel from here to there, travel from here to there. Nothing noteworthy happened during those 38 years. I'm teaching Jewish history now in the school, so I skip hundreds of years at a time, right? I'm trying to teach a survey course to subhuman 10th graders. So what am I supposed to do? So, a little bit of emotion getting out there.
Professional satisfaction I'm hearing.
Yeah, so you're back. You skip hundreds of years because nothing interesting, or at least from their perspective, happened during that time. So skip those 38 years because nothing interesting from its perspective happened. It alludes to it several times at the end of Bamidbar, also in Dvarim, where Moshe Rabbeinu tells the Jews, we went here, we went there. So in the events, all these counters that took place during those 38 years. But that's what Rabbi Schwab said, that these 38 years are precedent for 160.
What does everyone else say? Is the Gemara is right and everybody else is wrong?
Yeah, the rest of us say the Gemara is right and everybody else is wrong.
Okay.
Now in this case, it's important to know. All secular books, they're all really one book. That's the problem with textbooks. You find textbook and text, textbook after textbook after textbook the same day. It's probably taken from one source. There's one single lousy source, Herodotus. Herodotus, the Greek historian. And Herodotus himself was not a historian who went around compiling things scientifically. He told stories. And the dates he used were not dates. He said, he didn't say, now guys, listen to me. I listened to a lot of the books on it. It's very entertaining. It's very interesting to listen to. But he doesn't say, now, this is what happened in the year 586 before the Common Era. This is what happened in the year 570 before the Common Era. This is in the year 566 before the Common Era. He really does, obviously he didn't know about the Common Era, right? But he really doesn't use any consistent dating system at all.
From events?
No, he doesn't, because he just talks about generations. Which generation it happened in.
So how did they calculate it?
From Herodotus and from his list of Persian kings, they work backwards and a few archaeological finds, right, that, which are not necessarily conclusive. They went back with the conclusion this must be the, what's the word, the chronology, the proper chronology. So everything is based on Herodotus and interpretation of Herodotus, and which snowballed over the years and made it into hundreds and thousands of books. So it's really one-on-one. It's the Gemara against Herodotus. That's really what we're talking about. Okay, not so terrible. Actually, I can live with that. That's my actually, there was, by the way, I once tried to give shiur on this. I have a couple of tapes on the topic. I never tried to give it again. But there is a fellow, in Israel who tried to work on all reconciling where Herodotus, trying to point out Herodotus' mistakes, where he made mistakes. And his basis was the work of a famous mad scientist by the name of Emmanuel Velikovsky. Anybody here ever hear of Emmanuel Velikovsky?
No.
Oh, he's famous. He's the one who came up with the asteroid theory for the destruction of the dinosaurs, Yucatan Peninsula theory.
Oh, yeah.
But in his time, when he said that, everybody dismissed him as a nut. Right? 50 years later, they came around his way of thinking.
Now they're going against it again.
He wrote a famous... it'll go back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, he wrote a fascinating book. He was Jewish, but of course he was a Shirazi chorus, and he wrote an entire book, although this is not, he's not necessarily wrong, that's the problem with him. He wrote a book about how all these shifts in time, all the miracles occurred because of comets of the earth. And he proceeds to explain how each one of the miracles was a result of the comet hitting the earth.
Why is that a problem?
What?
Why is that a problem?
No, it's not a problem. The problem is that then he came to the conclusion that, as a result, all of it is no proof of anything. In other words, the fact that the miracles happen is only because of the comet hits the earth and not because there's a God. And at Har Sinai, what the Jews heard was the rumbling of an earthquake because of the comet. They didn't actually hear
but
God.
God sent the comet.
I'm just talking about the...
Oh, okay.
Yes.
All right.
Okay, you can... It's an interesting book to read. The book he wrote about that is called Worlds in Collision. He said that the moon which came down in the Midbar, he said it was... parts of the comet.
Parts of the comet?
Yeah. Edible.
I heard it was like gooey moss stuff grown on the rock.
No. It's
like
the parts of the comet which came down.
It just didn't fall once a week.
he also has his book on history is called The Sea Peoples. And he takes Herodotus, besides about this period, he takes Herodotus' attacks and says Herodotus botched up everything. And he shows, you know, it's complicated. He shows how Herodotus, from his perspective, took a set of Egyptian kings and put them in twice. As if they're two, the same set happened twice. It was really one set, which happened one time. But he got mixed up because they had different names. You know, some kings have several names, so therefore he expanded what should have been condensed. And there's a whole complicated way of working that out. So that actually is, you know, I tried again once to master that subject, and it got too complicated. But you're welcome to listen to my tapes on the topic when I tried to do it.
His explanation of why he was...
Not Velikovsky, it's Aronson, who was in Israel, explanation of how it works out according to Velikovsky.
About the dating.
So that is Rabbi Schwab's actually more controversial approach, And as I said, he retracted it later in life. There's a question as to whether he retracted it because he really retracted it, or retracted it because he was under pressure to retract. And that's why he took it back.
So he never read the Israeli guys?
No, that was way from the last Israeli guys.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So anyway, that is Rabbi Schwab's more controversial. When you speak to Rabbi Schwab Jr., you can ask him about that too.
Yeah, he gives a chumash here in the morning.
Yeah, so you should just ask him about it. So, as I said, the main difficulty with this approach is that there's no mention of it in Torah, which when Rabbi Schwab does, as you see now from Rabbi Schwab's other approach, that doesn't bother him, right? Because he's willing to come and say things, radical things, right? Because he supposes that they're logical and can be said. And therefore that doesn't bother. Okay, we'll come back to the rest of the answer, what I think is the most satisfying answer, on Monday. I'm supposed to teach tonight when I'm switching with Rabbi Foyer again this week, so Rabbi Foyer will be here tonight, and I'll be here.